From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
You're holding on for dear life to the shuttle or the station with one hand, and you are in between what is just a pouring glory of the world roaring by silently next to you. And when you look left, it's the whole bottomless black of the universe.
Today, retired astronaut Chris Hadfield talks about his 6 months in outer space and the amazing beauty and the life-threatening dangers he faced, like the time he was upgrading the computers that run the International Space Station.
Here we go. Okay, 3, 2, 1, and everything quit. And suddenly, we were really helpless.
Hadfield is famous for the YouTube video of him singing David Bowie's Space Oddity while floating in the space station. He has a new book of photographs of Earth that he took from space titled You Are Here. And David Edelstein reviews the new film Birdman, starring Michael Keaton and Edward Norton. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
While floating weightless in outer space at the International Space Station, today's guest, Commander Chris Hadfield, recorded this version of David Bowie's Space Oddity. It was turned into a video that had music rights permission to be posted for only 1 year. But during that year, it got more than 22 million hits on YouTube. Hadfield has flown 3 space missions, conducted 2 space walks, and spent a total of 6 months in space. He's witnessed awe-inspiring beauty, faced life-threatening dangers, and held onto a spaceship orbiting Earth at 17,500 miles an hour. Hadfield is the author of the book An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, and a brand new photo book called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes. A former Royal Canadian Air Force fighter and test pilot, he's been the director of operations of NASA in Star City, Russia, and the chief of International Space Station operations in Houston. In space, he's served as the commander of the International Space Station. Terry Gross spoke with Chris Hadfield in 2013 when his Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth was first published.
Commander Hadfield, welcome to Fresh Air. I just want to start with your Major Tom video, since that's gotten over 18 million views. Talk about going
that's
viral.
That's crazy.
So is it hard to sing and play guitar in space?
It is actually subtly hard. Singing, it's weird because your sinuses never drain without gravity. It's sort of like standing on your head forever, and no professional singer stands on their head forever before a performance because it kind of fills up your tongue and your sinuses, and you sound a little bit congested. So it changed the timbre of my voice for sure. And then guitar, when you move your left hand up and down the fretboard, because the guitar is floating weightless, it kind of flies along with your hand, so you constantly miss with your left hand. Clumsy popping recordings. So it's a little bit new to both sing and play up there, but with enough takes, eventually you can get something that's worth listening to.
How did you start doing videos in space about how to brush your teeth and make a peanut butter and honey burrito, a demo of how you sleep?
I started making just little, what I hope were insightful videos of, you know, how do you walk to work in Star City, Russia, or what does the simulator look like in Scuba, Japan? So it sort of set the stage. And then once I got to orbit, what really precipitated it for me was a can of peanuts. I opened up a can of peanuts, and when I looked inside, it looked like it was full of bees. And I just thought, wow, and I kind of like closed the lid again. But then I opened it again and realized it's just all these peanuts floating around in weightlessness, and it just looked so surprisingly cool. So I just grabbed my iPad and made a short, I don't know, 15-second video of nuts in a can and sent it down to the space agency, and they put it out on the YouTube site, and it's been seen by millions and millions and millions of people. And it kind of just clicked in my mind, and in the space agency's mind, of course, that if we can show the experience using technology that exists, people's interest will drive them to it, and they will actually be curious.
I just want to say thank you. I love that you've done that.
You're welcome.
That's great. So how many times were you actually out in space, out of the capsule or out of the space station?
Well, I've been so lucky to have done 2 spacewalks. If you looked at your wristwatch, I was outside about 15 hours, which is about 10 times around the world. And, you know, there's a whole time dilation.
Excuse me, I just have to interrupt. I just have to interrupt and say that's just mind-boggling.
Oh, it's even more mind-boggling if you're the human being out there doing it, Terry. It's the contrast of your body and your mind inside a little one-person, essentially a one-person spaceship, which is your little spacesuit, where you're holding on for dear life to the shuttle or the station with one hand, and you are inexplicably in between what is just a pouring glory of the world roaring by silently next to you. The kaleidoscope of it is just, it takes up your whole mind. It's like the most beautiful thing you've ever seen just screaming at you on the right side. And when you look left, it's the whole bottomless black of the universe. And It goes in all directions. It's like a huge yawning endlessness just on your left side. And you're in between those two things and trying to rationalize it to yourself and trying to get some work done.
Now, during those 15 hours when you were doing spacewalks, was there always a technical reason to be out there? Was it always part of the mission, or was it
recreationally?
No, like, this is so cool, I'm just going to go outside and enjoy it.
It's a really big deal to do a spacewalk. It's much riskier than staying indoors. It's complex. It uses up a lot of the precious resources on board. It uses up oxygen, uses up carbon dioxide scrubbers. You know, we only go out when we absolutely have to, whether it's to build something that takes the ingenuity and dexterity of a person, or if it's to fix something, if you had an emergency and you need to fix something that broke. And those are the only reasons we go outside, and we train for it in a detail you just wouldn't believe to make it go right.
Now, you write in your book that when you did a spacewalk, my number one concern was to avoid floating off into space, which is a pretty major concern.
Seems like a good idea, yeah.
Yeah. So how are you tethered to, what was it, the space station that you were tethered to?
When I did my spacewalks, it was during space station construction. So the shuttle was docked to the fledgling ISS at the time. So we would always stay tethered.
The ISS is the International Space Station.
Yeah, that's right, International Space Station. Sorry for the acronym. Tethered means basically like a clothesline that you have clipped somewhere on structure. So you're either clipped to the shuttle or to the space station somewhere. There's little handrails and loops and things you can attach to. And you go from one to the other, like a high building construction worker or something. So you're always tied off so that if your hand did slip, you started drifting off into space. I mean, there's nobody could come rescue you. So you have a tether, and it reels out to about 50 or 60 feet long if it had to. But you also wear a jetpack. Just in case that tether were to fail, you could pull down a handle on your right side. A little joystick pops out in front of you. You grab it, you turn it on, and then you can fly yourself with, it's just a simple system of a nitrogen tank and little thrusters, but you could fly yourself over and grab back onto the mothership.
Tell us something else that you saw during a spacewalk that has nothing comparable on Earth.
I was coming across the Indian Ocean in the dark. I was riding on the end of the robot arm, so I had some time. I was actually carrying a bunch of laundry because we deployed a new piece and it had blankets on it, thermal blankets. So basically it was like riding a cherry picker back, carrying a big bag of laundry in my arm. So I didn't have much to do until the arm could get me back. Coming across the Indian Ocean, coming up in Australia, I thought, I want to look at Australia in the dark because everyone lives along the coast, starting with Perth and across, and it's like a necklace of cities. So I shut off my lights, and I let my eyes completely adjust to the darkness. But as we came south under Australia, instead of seeing just the lights of the cities of Australia, we flew into the southern lights. And just like the northern lights, they erupt out of the world. And it's almost as if like someone has put on this huge, fantastic laser light show for thousands of miles. And the colors, of course, with your naked eye are so much more vivid than just a camera. They're greens and yellows and reds and oranges. And they poured up under my feet. I mean, the ribbons and curtains of it. It was surreal to look at driving through the southern lights. And I said to Jeff Ashby, who was driving the arm, I said, hey, Jeff, you got to see this, the southern lights. So the arm jerked to a stop, and they shut off all the lights in the shuttle and put their noses to the glass and looked at the lights with me for a while until we skirted across Australia and back up across New Zealand and into the sunrise.
Your longest mission was 146 days in space. I think during that one trip, you orbited Earth 2,336 times and traveled almost 62 miles. You probably hear
62 million miles.
I'm sorry, 62 million miles, yes. you probably hear a lot of frequent flyer jokes, so I will not bother to make any. And you see another sunrise every 92 minutes, which must be very odd and disorienting.
They happen really fast, the sunrises. Sometimes you specifically set the alarm on your watch to go watch the sunrise. And as you pull yourself down into the floor. That's where the huge bulging window is that we call the cupola. And there's the world glowing dark underneath you. And you start to see a few faint tinges of a sunrise coming as it starts to light the upper atmosphere. And then, bam, the sun just pops into view, roars into view, because we're coming around the world at it so fast. And you can actually watch the sun move away from the Earth. And the light from it initially comes through the atmosphere. So the whole station glows with the light of dawn, with all the big solar rays glow blood red and then orange. And then as the sun clears the atmosphere and it's directly on us, then they settle down to sort of an iridescent blue. And then you can see the dawn come across the world towards you. And then you go back to work and wait another 92 minutes and it happens again. It's not to be missed. And I tried to watch as many sunrises and sunsets as the work would allow.
Wow. I'm thinking of the contrast between the claustrophobia you must experience when you're in the space shuttle or the space station compared to the sense of the infinite when you're out on a spacewalk.
They don't want claustrophobic astronauts. And so NASA is careful through selection to try and see if you have a natural tendency to be afraid of small spaces or not. And really, it's good if you've managed to find a way to deal with all of your fears, especially the irrational ones. So during selection, in fact, they zip you inside a ball, and they don't tell you how long they're going to leave you in there. And so I think if you had tendencies toward claustrophobia, then that would probably panic you, and they would use it as a discriminator to decide whether they're going to hire you or not. For me, being zipped inside a small, dark place for an indeterminate amount of time was just a great opportunity, nice time to think and maybe have a little nap and relax. And so it doesn't bother me. But you can get claustrophobia and agoraphobia, a fear of wide open spaces, simultaneously on a spacewalk. You are enclosed inside your little spacesuit with a helmet and a cap on, a Snoopy cap, and some microphones right down touching your mouth and stuff in front of your face and your whole body enclosed. If you're susceptible to claustrophobia, that might be a trigger. But when you look outside, when you look through your visor, you are standing on nothing with 250 miles of emptiness between you and the world.
Commander Chris Hadfield speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2013 interview with Commander Chris Hadfield. The astronaut and author has written a memoir called An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth and has a new photo book called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes.
One of the exercises that you basically put yourself through in preparing, or that NASA puts you through, in preparing to be an astronaut is what you describe as, what's the next thing that will kill me? Because there are so many things that can go wrong and be life-threatening in space. Give us a sense of what that what's the next thing that will kill me training process is like.
Terry, I found it to be so helpful in my regular life, and I didn't mean it to be that way. But of course, as an astronaut, especially during launch, half of the risk of a six-month flight is in the first 9 minutes. So as a crew, how do you stay focused? And how do you not get paralyzed by the fear of it? And the way we do it is to break down what are the risks. And a nice way to keep reminding yourself is, what's the next thing that's going to kill me? And it might be 5 seconds away. It might be an inadvertent engine shutdown, or it might be staging of the solid rockets coming off, or it might be, you know, some transition or some key next thing. We've already, say, had one computer fail and we've had one hydraulic system fail. So if these three things fail now, we need to react right away or we're done. So we don't just live with that, though. And the thing that is really useful, I think, out of all this is we dig into it so deeply and we look at, okay, so this might kill us. This is something that would normally panic us. Let's get ready. Let's think about it. And we go into every excruciating detail of why that might affect what we're doing and what we can do to resolve it and have a plan and be comfortable with it and practice it.
And you say in order to make this work, you have to neutralize fear.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like astronauts are braver than other people. We're just, you know, meticulously prepared. We dissect what it is that is going to scare us and what it is that is a threat to us. And then we practice over and over again so that the natural irrational fear is neutralized. And your first reaction is not just to scream and flee with your hands waving over your head, but in fact to go, hey, we thought about this. And I know that this is dangerous, but there are six things that I could do right now, all of which will help make things better. And it's worth remembering, too, there's no problem so bad that you can't make it worse also. So you have to practice and learn what's the right thing to do. But given that, it actually gives you a really great comfort. It's counterintuitive, you know, to visualize disaster. But by visualizing disaster, that's what keeps us alive.
Tell us about one of the most dangerous things that went wrong during one of your spacewalks.
Probably the most dangerous time was I was working away. I was operating the great big pistol grip tool. It looks like an enormous electric drill. I was tightening up some bolts, building a huge mechanical robot arm, the Canadarm2, and suddenly my left eye stopped working. And there'd been some little balls of water floating around inside my helmet, my water bag that we get drinking water of. It's like a little camelback, had been leaking slightly. But my eye just stung, you know, like a hornet had stung it or something. It just hurt, and it slammed itself shut. And I couldn't see through it. I tried to open it, and, you know, when your eye has really been hurt, you just can't open it and look through it. And I couldn't rub it because it's inside my helmet. And I tried to touch something with my eye, but it's inside like a fishbowl. I couldn't do anything. So I thought, well, I can still hear, I can still breathe, I can still see, and one of my eyes is working perfectly. So maybe it's just a transient thing. I'll keep on working. But what I hadn't really thought through was that my eye would start tearing, crying, of course, just like the good flushing reaction, you know, that works on Earth. But tears in space, tears don't fall. They just build up a big ball of contaminated tear on your eye, and it doesn't drain the bad stuff away and squirt in new tear. So I get this bigger and bigger ball of whatever that stuff was on my left eye until, unfortunately, the ball got big enough that it went across the bridge of my nose into my right eye. And now suddenly, instantly, both my eyes are blind. And I try as I might, I couldn't get them open. All I could see was a complete blur. So now it was time to fess up and, you know, Houston, I have a problem. And I used to work in mission control. I was the chief Capcom for NASA for about 25 shuttle flights. So I worked as a Capcom in mission control, Capcom being the astronaut that talks to the crews in orbit. So I really understand how that room works and how the flight director and the doctors and everybody would react when I told them that I was blind on a spacewalk. And they went into hyper mode and you know, good calming voices, but coming up with lots of, you know, reactions that would try and fix my eyes or diagnose the problem. They thought maybe I had a problem where the chemical that purifies our air was maybe leaking into the suit, and some of the early symptoms are eye irritation, but it also really hurts your lungs. So they said, strangely enough, their first big recommendation was, we'd like you to open the purge valve on the side of your helmet and start dumping your oxygen out to space. So I'm just kind of smiling to myself, thinking, this is not how I thought my first spacewalk was going to go, where I'm blinded and now I open a hole and I'm listening to a very limited supply of oxygen hiss out into the universe. And I just kept blinking and crying and blinking and crying. And after a while, I thought maybe I could start to see just a little bit. It took about a half hour, I think. And then I finished the spacewalk. And it turned out to just be the stuff we put on the visor to make it not fog up. It was sort of like a soapy, oily kind of chemical, that no fog stuff. But a floating ball of water had picked up the no fog stuff, and it's just as if I'd taken the no fog and squirted it into my eyeball.
What about your sense of orientation and your sense of balance if you can't see and you're, you know, orbiting in space?
You know, that's a really perceptive question because a lot of people don't think about that, even astronauts. What does it feel like when you close your eyes when you're weightless? Normally on Earth, when you close your eyes, you can feel your feet on the floor, your rear end on your chair or something, and that gives you a sense of up. And you can balance with your eyes closed. You can walk with your eyes closed because of all of the external references. When you're weightless and you close your eyes, it's as if you just stepped off a cliff into complete blackness and you're falling forever. And so the perception of that is really odd. And you can do it as like a thought experiment. And instead of just closing your eyes and thinking that you're floating, close your eyes and picture that you've just stepped off the Half Dome in Yosemite and are now falling into the blackness. And it's interesting to see how your body reacts to it. Because that's a real fear-making thing normally.
Astronaut and author Chris Hadfield speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. We'll continue their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from ITVS with the independent lens film Twin Sisters, about twins adopted separately who share an unshakable bond, Monday at 10 Eastern on PBS. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. And from Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. This is NPR.
Coming up, more about life in space and why re-entering Earth's atmosphere can be like riding inside a blast furnace. We continue our interview with astronaut Chris Hadfield. We'll also talk about the difficulty of adjusting to life on Earth with gravity. And David Edelstein reviews the new film, Birdman. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2013 interview with Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. He's written a memoir called An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth and a new photo book called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes. Hadfield flew 3 space missions, did 2 space walks, and spent a total of 6 months in space. He served as the commander of the International Space Station. And on Earth, he's been the chief of International Space Station operations in Houston and director of operations for NASA in Star City, Russia.
You had to do some technical work in space. What are some of the problems of working in a weightless gravityless atmosphere?
It's really non-intuitive. But having grown up and adapted and expected everything to behave like it does on Earth, you know, if you drop your hammer, it falls to the floor. If you let go of a little tiny washer, it doesn't float up and back behind your ear. Something like a fuse, you know, just in a fuse box. You know how it works on Earth. There's a little too much electricity. We don't want to burn up the house. So this little tiny fuse, there's a little skinny bit of metal in the middle, and it gets hot and melts. And then it falls away, and it breaks the electrical circuit. Like nice, simple, earthbound design. Well, if you have a fuse like that in space, of course, the little fuse will get hot and melt, but it won't drop away because there's no gravity. So the current will continue to flow through the fuse until something else gets hot. So something as simple as a fuse or a fan on a projector or all kinds of stuff where you're counting on convection and gravity, they all have to be rethought. And it catches you unawares all the time. Trying to do up my shoe to go running on the treadmill. You know, it's so easy on Earth. You bend over, do up your shoe. But if you think about it, when you're doing up your running shoe, you are using both hands and one foot. And so there's nothing to hold you in place anymore. You always sit down or lean on something on Earth. But in space, suddenly you're this uncontrolled 180-pound mass bouncing off everything else because you got no free hands anymore, and you're just trying to do up your shoes. So something as esoteric as designing cooling systems for standard equipment or something as prosaic as just doing up your shoes, you have to rethink it all in order to not be clumsy but also to be successful when you go to a new environment like that.
There are so many times when I'm on my computer and it freezes, or, you know, I get that ball that goes around and around and around, or like the old-fashioned buffering. Have you had the equivalent in space where, like, a really important computer just has a really, like, standard frustrating problem, but it's like, it's your life at stake here?
Fairly early on when I was on the space station in this half-year trip up there, Terry, we were doing a major computer upgrade. It had been tested on the ground, and computers run the space station. It's not run by switches and knobs. It's run by computers and software. And we were doing a major upgrade. And it had been tested left, right, and center, and all the simulators on the ground, and we were all ready for it. And, you know, Houston said it was in our plans and everything. Here we go. Okay, 3, 2, 1, and everything quit. And the fans were shutting off, and we couldn't communicate with the ground, and all the software locked up, and nothing was working. And suddenly, we were really helpless, because a lot of the safety of the space station is controlled by what we would react to on the computer. A lot of the insight we have, whether there's smoke somewhere or whether something's malfunctioning, is told to us by the computers. And we had a full lockup. And it's not just your laptop quitting and not getting to your email for a minute. It's the actual control of the whole spaceship. So not a shining moment for us as the crew. But we'd been trained for it. And so we ran around the ship checking to see the status of everything. We became sort of the canaries in the mine of knowing that our smoke detectors wouldn't work. And so racing around to make sure that seeing if there's smoke somewhere. We were coming up across the Pacific and about to cross South America, so I got on the ham radio, the amateur radio, and tried to talk to people in Brazil. So I'm listening to these guys chattering in Portuguese to each other while I'm trying to say, hey, I'd like to break in, and could you please call Houston so that tell them we can't talk to them anymore and this is what we're doing. But meanwhile, Tom and Kevin and I, Kevin was the commander of the ship at the time, Kevin Ford, there's a whole backup booting sort of software that's called Mighty Mouse. And we dug into Mighty Mouse, and we went into the backup procedures, and we bring paper procedures up just in case the digital ones let us down. And it was actually a really fun moment for the crew because we'd trained for this sort of thing. And Kevin, the commander, was behind us with the procedure. Tom and I were the two guys entering the procedures, checking each other out, you know, command, challenge, response type procedures, checking through it, ticking through it. Took several hours getting ready as we came across Russia, because when we came over the Russian ground sites, we could use the assets in the Russian end of the station just with a straight radio, like a VHF radio, just to talk directly. So we had our big list of questions, and Houston got ready. So when we came over Russia, there was this high-speed communication of trying to tell us what to do next, and then we went silent as we crossed over the Sea of Japan. worked again for the whole way around the world, trying to bring all the, nurse them back to life, all the computers back to life. And I think it took two times around the world. But after that, we had things fixed, got things back to life, had reverted to the old software. And then, of course, the experts on the ground tried to figure out what little glitch had gone wrong. It ended up being, you know, just a small, subtle thing, but something they could fix, and then we could upgrade the system later. But, you know, we spent decades training for what we're supposed to do up there. We have to be the geek squad, you know, the guys that show up to fix your computer. We are those guys, so fortunately, we could deal with it.
Well, would you describe what it's like to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere?
It's like riding inside a blast furnace. You come into the upper atmosphere, and it gets to 3,000 degrees on the outside of the ship. You can see the orange and yellow flames licking around your vehicle. You can hear the metal responding to the heat. In the Soyuz, the little Russian capsule, you can actually hear the banging of the big shield, the big heat shield on the bottom as it slowly erodes away from the heat and pieces of it fly off like sparks across your window. And it's an interesting thing to ride through. You know, it makes you think, riding as this little bubble inside a blast furnace, and there's nowhere to put your heat. You know, you can't get colder while you're inside that. There is no, the ship gets warmer and warmer. And the shuttle came back because its purpose was to carry big cargo home, and we could put a huge telescope or payload in the back, like a great big dump truck. It had wings, and it could come back so gently and be not much different once you'd made it through the hot part, not much different than an airliner, maybe slightly more force, but then circle around, just a glider, didn't have engines, but come down and land either in California at Edwards, where I used to be a test pilot, or on the runway at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, right where we'd launched from. So that was relatively comfortable. The Soyuz, though, it's a very simple, rugged, tough little design, and it's more like riding a meteorite. And if you do it everything perfectly, you come in with a lot of vibration and about four times your weight, 4G. So after being weightless for half a year, Yeah, it's really unfair to have to get squished like that. And if it goes a little bit wrong, it reverts to a mode where you don't fly it at all. It's just ballistic. And then you pull about 8 or 9 G, which is – that would be hard on anybody, let alone someone who's been thinking they're Superman flying around elegantly for so long. And then the parachute opens very violently. But then you're just coming down under a parachute, but you're bracing yourself for that last second, which is impact with the world. And, you know, the Soyuz craft weighs tons, and you're lying on the floor of it on your back. But the Russians do tell you, remember, before you land, stop talking so you don't bite your tongue off.
Okay.
That's how violent the landing's going to be. And it hits the ground. There's little retro rockets that fire, and they cushion it, but it still hits the ground like a car crash. And we land on the prairies of Kazakhstan, and so it's always windy. So you don't just come straight down and go plunk. You hit the ground, and then you tumble end over end in this little thing. And finally, it rolls to a stop. And
how come you don't break all your bones? Because you've lost bone mass in space. That's one of the physiological changes, one of the unfortunate ones that astronauts experience. So how do your bones survive a crash like that?
They pour us a special crash seat like a Formula One driver. And it's funny, they put you in this tub and they pour gypsum in around you and they make a perfect mold of your rear end to build this crash seat from. So in the museum on the outskirts of Moscow, there's a beautiful rear end exhibit of every cosmonaut and astronaut who's ever flown in the Soyuz, how we all looked. But they build you a crash seat that supports your lower back and your neck and your head so that when you hit the ground, you won't break any, you know, your spine or your neck. And then you put your hands in a position so that they're not going to flail. And your legs actually have this like a brassiere cross strap that's latched your knees down so your legs don't splay out and rip up your tendons or break a bone. And in truth, we do get osteoporosis because of the weightlessness, but we're learning how to beat it. And the only part of my skeleton that got reduced density was just across my hip and my upper femur. And I did lose bone there, especially the the sort of the spongy bone. So now my bone is much more brittle and liable to break. But what's interesting, Terry, is it's reversing. As I'm sitting here talking to you, I am regrowing bone, and my osteoporosis, it's a type of osteoporosis, is reversing. So there's something going on in the body that we would really dearly love to know how it's actually doing it that can reverse some of the effects of osteoporosis. And after about a year after I get back, so next spring, I should have the same skeleton that I launched with. And so I'm a big lab rat right now that they're studying to try and understand both the fragility of my hip cradle as it exists right now and how the body is deciding to grow that spongy trabecular bone back.
Well, it'd be great if one of the results of the space program was research that helped reverse or prevent osteoporosis.
Oh, it is, in fact, because we used to get it much more prevalently across our body, and we've designed equipment on board, exercise equipment that specifically targets those parts of the body so that we don't lose bone in those areas. And we just haven't quite got it completely solved yet. But we have a form of a treadmill with big bungees and a sort of a bicycle with no seat on it, and then a big resistive exercise machine, and we work out 2 hours a day, 7 days a week, the whole time we're up there, just to fight muscle loss, but also to keep force your body into keeping a strong skeleton. And we're learning a lot from that, and people are publishing papers all the time talking about how to avoid the effects of typical aging on Earth.
Commander Chris Hadfield speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2013 interview with Commander Chris Hadfield. The former astronaut is the author of An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, and he has a new photo book called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes.
You write that for every day in space, you need a day on Earth to physically recover because your body goes through so many physiological changes while you're in a weightless atmosphere in space, and you compare it to the physiological changes of aging. Your arteries harden, your bones start to thin. So just tell us physically what it feels like as you're adjusting to gravity back on Earth. What are some of the most aggravating parts of that?
When you first get back, it's like you just got off the worst ride at the fair, the thing that spins you and tumbles you, and you're afraid you're going to throw up at any second, or you may have already thrown up, in fact, because it just messes up your inner ear so badly. And when you first come back to Earth, that's how you feel. It's awful. You know, nobody likes feeling like they're on the verge of throwing up. You know, the sweats that come with that and the exhaustion and your body's reactions to it. So I felt like that for days. And it's not pleasant. You can't get the blood in your head anymore. Your body has forgotten how to squeeze the blood all the way from the tips of your toes all the way up to your heart and to your head. Your body just hasn't had to do it for months and months. It hasn't had to lift the blood against gravity. So you actually wear like Spanx or whatever, a G-suit on your calf and your thigh and your lower body, like holding the bottom of a balloon in your hand to squeeze the top to make it bulge. You have to wear that for several days. So those take some getting used to. And you're so clumsy when you walk. You know, it's like you're drunk or super tired, or you're just staggering around. They won't let us drive, of course, for a while, and we can't fly airplanes for quite a while. But after about a month, I felt reasonably normal, but I couldn't run. As your legs pound into the pavement, it's sort of like throwing the blood at the ground that's in your legs, you know, like dropping a balloon of blood down each time, the acceleration of your legs and the running. And my body just couldn't get the blood back up to my head. And so running it took about 4 months before I felt normal running again.
I'm wondering about the transformative nature of the experience of being in space and doing spacewalks. I don't know if you were ever religious or not. Either way, I'm wondering if being in space changed your concept of your place in the universe and whether any sense of spirituality or organized religion or a god figures into that or not as a result.
It's an amazing place to think about that topic. You know, picture yourself separated from the other 6.5-7 billion people, where you can see them all from a distance. You know, every 90 minutes you go around and the world turns underneath you like a big jewel. And you have left all of them. And you're looking at, it's almost like a godlike view of the world, right? You're, at least our limited human understanding of what that godlike view might be, looking down almost paternally on everybody. And so it really makes you think. And the world, you look at it, it just can't be random looking at it. I mean, it's so different than the vast emptiness that is everything else. And even all the other planets we've seen, you know, at least in our solar system, you know, none of them even remotely resemble the precious, life-giving nature of our own planet. Maybe there's life on Mars too, but the big pervasive feeling on board at looking at the Earth is one of tremendous, exquisite privilege that it exists. And so we talk about religion on board all the time, and we have all different faiths, you know, because the astronauts come from all around the world and cosmonauts. I mean, we respect each other's faiths. And I hate to talk publicly about my own just because people really get a lot of strength out of their own set of beliefs. And if you start talking in depth about your own, you're excluding other people who have different faiths that give them strength. And there's no point in that. I have huge respect for how people get strength and the faith that gives that to them. And I think what everyone would find if they could be in that position, if they could see the whole world every 90 minutes and look down on the places where we do things right and look down where we're doing stupid, brutal things to each other, and the inevitable patience of the world that houses us, I think everybody would be reinforced in their faith and maybe readdress the real true tenets of what's good and what gives them strength.
So you do have a faith. I'm not asking you to tell us what it is, but you do have a faith, a religious faith, and felt that that was affirmed in space.
Oh, absolutely. The things that you believe that give you the strength. I mean, there are no wishy-washy astronauts. You know, you don't get up there by being uncaring and blasé. And whatever gave you the sense of tenacity and purpose to get that far in life is absolutely reaffirmed and deepened by the experience itself.
I want to thank you so much for the work that you've done in space, for the risks you've taken, and for the wonderful videos that you've sent that are so enlightening about and fun about what life in space is like. You know, an interesting thing about talking to you and reading your book, it's like one of the extra qualifications that you brought to your work as an astronaut is your ability to be a reporter, to describe so well what it is you've seen and then send us back reports. You know, for those of us who aren't experts, send
space
us back.
Space correspondent.
Yes,
here.
Exactly. No, it's a wonderful thing. So thank you for all that. I wish you all the best, and thanks for doing this interview.
Thanks very much, Terry. It's been tremendous fun, the whole thing. It's a wonderful adventure, and I count myself so lucky to have been a part of it.
Astronaut and author Chris Hadfield speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. His new book of photos from space is called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Birdman, the new film starring Michael Keaton. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The new film Birdman closed the recent New York Film Festival and has been mentioned as a likely awards contender. It's directed by Alejandro Iñárritu, best known for the films Babel and 21 Grams, and stars Michael Keaton as an actor much like Michael Keaton. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
You'll probably be wowed by Birdman, by how the camera hurtles after characters in what's made to look like a single, fluid, movie-long take, transcending space and often time, even soaring off into fantasy, while viscerally evoking the desperation of a washed-up film actor to bring off his Broadway debut. You should be wowed. I was too, and I didn't even like the movie. I had to marvel at director Alejandro González Iñárritu's choreography, at the gopher-broke performances. The film is an empty masterwork. Michael Keaton plays the actor, Regan Thompson, and who doesn't want to see him, Keaton I mean, back on top? He gave us Beetlejuice, the bio-exorcist, one of the modern screen's most rollicking comic creations, and he proved his straight-acting chops in movies like Clean and Sober and, yes, Batman. Regan, like Keaton, made his fortune in the role of a superhero, Birdman, but after a long, fallow period, he's frantic to prove himself in a self-penned, self-directed adaptation of Raymond Carver's story collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. That camera trails him from his dressing room, often chased by Zach Galifianakis as his harried producer, past Naomi Watts as an insecure actress, and Edward Norton as her hot dog actor boyfriend, with periodic harangues by a fiercely overacting Emma Stone as Regan's fresh-from-rehab daughter. Between clashes, Regan is taunted by the voice of his old character, Birdman, who reminds him of his sorry state. How the superheroic have fallen. On the street, Regan fights with Norton's Mike, who just made a ruckus in rehearsal. They pass a drummer, who turns up periodically in the film, to make your heartbeat even faster.
Let's go. Walk.
Where are we going?
Get you some coffee. Did I do something to disrespect you?
Not yet.
Look, I have a lot riding on this play.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. People know who I am.
They don't know you, your work, man. They know the guy from the bird suit who goes and tells coy, slightly vomitous stories on Letterman.
Well, I'm sorry if I'm popular, Mike.
Popular?
You know,
I don't give a popular. Popularity is the slutty little cousin of prestige, my friend.
Okay, I don't even know what that means, so.
Well, it means my reputation is riding on this, and that's worth
a lot,
exactly.
Right.
Yes. If this doesn't work out for you, you off back to your studio pals and dive back into that cultural genocide you guys are perpetrating. You know, a douchebag's born every minute. That was P.T. Barnum's premise when he invented the circus, and nothing much has changed. And you guys know that if you crank out any toxic piece of crap, people will line up and pay to see it. But long after you're gone, I'm gonna be on that stage, earning my living, bearing my soul, wrestling with complex human emotions,
because
that's what we do.
Oh, so is that what tonight was about, you wrestling with complex emotions?
Tonight was just about seeing if it's even alive, seeing if it can bleed. No, this isn't a backlot, Regan. This is New York City. This is how we do things.
Norton is one of Birdman's bright spots. His character exists on a level of jerky entitlement that's positively mythic. But what comes out of the other characters' mouths is not so fresh. We learn that Regan wasn't there for his daughter growing up, that he was lousy to his wife, played by Amy Ryan, and that he has an actress girlfriend, played by Andrea Riseborough, to whom he can't make the ultimate commitment. Mostly, Regan marinates in self-pity. For all his energy, he's tiresome. The movie grinds you down. And when Regan takes off into the air like a bird, it means nothing. The magic realism is only there to psych you out. And director Iñárritu never bothers to tell us if this stage adaptation of Raymond Carver deserves to succeed, if it's good. The snippets we see are stilted, though the audience looks enraptured. I don't think he has much respect for the medium of theater. I admit that Birdman, which carries the subtitle, Or the Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, didn't endear me with its nasty jabs at critics. The low point is a scene with a smug New York Times chief drama critic played by Lindsay Duncan. She pens her reviews, improbably, in a theater district bar and tells Regan that, sight unseen, she'll destroy his show because he's a movie star. As if critics these days aren't delighted, along with everyone else, to see film actors test themselves on stage and fill houses. But I actually do agree with Iñárritu that a lot of critics are intellectual peons. How else to explain the rave reviews he got for the pretend depths of his movies 21 Grams and Babel and Beautiful?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Sheehan directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Viking River Cruises, sailing through the heart of cities in Europe, Russia, and Asia, exploring the world in comfort. More at VRC.com. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, using the power of nutrition to help patients with cancer, as described in the new book, Cancer Nutrition and Recipes for Dummies. And from ITVS, with the independent lens film, Twin Sisters, about twins adopted separately who share an unshakable bond, Monday at 10 Eastern on PBS. This is NPR.
We have a criminal justice system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Brian Stevenson, a lawyer and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, which provides legal defense for the poor, the mentally challenged, children, and the wrongly condemned. Stevenson has a new memoir called Just Mercy. Join us.